Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Vanity Fair.
That'd make you William the...
Fifth.
Better than second. He was assassinated by his brother.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Hilary Busis.
And I'm Chris Murphy. And we're here to discuss the final episode of the final season, season 6, of the Netflix series The Crown. Episode 10, it's called Sleep, Dearie, Sleep.
And while Rome burns and the temple falls, we will sleep, dearie, sleep.
Later on, executive producer Suzanne Mackey, who is Peter Morgan's right-hand woman, will be stopping by to talk about the end of The Crown and how they put this finale together.
But first, our final recap. The Queen is planning her funeral, but Charles is angling to plan a wedding and make Camilla his queen.
Are you having any last-minute doubts?
Not me. I'm in.
For all of it?
For whatever being married to you turns out to be.
Prince William and Harry are off to a costume party. I wonder what could go wrong.
Germany had an empire, didn't they? What about this?
I don't know. Maybe cover the swastika?
Oh, come on. Wearing the outfit doesn't make him a Nazi.
The Queen wrestles with the idea of stepping down to hand the shop over to Charles as his wedding gift. But she's visited by two queens out of the past.
This system is a dreadful thing to inflict upon people. It's not natural. It's not fair. But you seem to thrive in it. And more importantly, it seems to thrive under you.
And the crown ultimately proves too strong, and the queen queens on.
The system makes no sense anymore to those outside it, nor to those of us inside it.
So I feel like one of you predicted that this show was going to end with Charles and Camilla getting married.
I think it was me.
I'm going to have to hand that to Hillary.
Yeah, yeah. I think you, I mean, you called it exactly.
Like, the true love story of The Crown.
Yeah. Mm. Do we buy this as a logical ending place for the series in terms of like Charles and Camilla get married, thus preparing him for being king while the queen has a sort of career crisis, if you want to call it a career? Does that make sense as like a sort of stopping point for the show?
Well,
thematically, I guess.
You know, it's called The Crown, but it is effectively still mostly about Elizabeth.
Yeah.
So I guess in as much as you want to give her an arc and end with her, then I think it makes sense. Because I guess if you go beyond 2005, like, what's she really doing?
Yeah, until we get to 2017 or whenever when Meghan gets into the picture. I mean, it's like, if we want to avoid all of the craziness that is to come in terms of William and Harry and Meghan and Kate and the rumors and the nastiness, if you will, then you got to end it, like, around here, and this is as good a place as any, but I felt myself being like, damn, there's a lot more to the story that we're not getting into, and that I guess we'll just never see play out on The Crown in terms of what happens with the whole family.
Yeah, I mean, this episode, I mean, there's a lot to talk about in this episode, but I because you brought up the Harry thing, like, I think that obviously, with the William and Harry stuff in this episode, kind of like they're fighting, there are some loaded looks cast at each other, there are little moments of reconciliation. The show is trying to say it's going to be a bumpy road for these boys going forward. I don't know that that's enough, because it was less of a bumpy road and more like one of the cars drove off the road,
yes.
You know, like, and I think that to not, well, look, to not approach the sort of race angle of what Meghan Markle, in, you know, represented to that family and whatever, mm-hmm. that's the worst example of the show soft peddling I can think of to date, maybe. I mean, the Prince Philip stuff too, but like, it's also just like you're leaving juicy television on the table.
So much. And again, this was, I understand why they ended here, and Imelda Staunton, you know, a treasure of an actress, and we got a lot of her facing her mortality and long looks at the camera and a lot of just, you know, less stiff upper lip acting and more like, let me look back on my past mm-hmm. acting. But I was like, it's a little anticlimactic. It's a little boring when there's so much juicy stuff coming.
She was walking along that hallway
that
for
was a long walk.
That is, I was like, oh, it's still going. Good Lord. Oh, she's going to go all the way to the door and then out the door, and then the door is going to close.
Of course. Well, the queen is an angel. And that was, those were the gates of heaven opening up, welcoming her in.
There is a, we're being a little hard on it. I mean, there's a moving aspect to it.
Yes.
Like, you know, it's natural for somebody her age to have to confront her mortality. But when you are the queen and when you are, you know, head of the line of succession and, you know, your death is not just like the death of a person, but sets a whole like,
chain.
You know, machine into motion, a whole chain of events. Yeah. Then, I mean, that must be very strange. Like, I think that there's a poignancy to, you know, watching her having to plan her own funeral. Like mm-hmm. That's not something that a person usually does.
No, it's not. I mean, I also think that within the context of the show, let's forget the actual real history and what's to come and what came before. I am always a sucker for what a long, strange trip it's been kind of endings with like her dialoguing with the past Elizabeth and just thinking, oh, wow, we've traversed so many years with these characters. I'm doing air quotes. And then Philip having, I thought for the crown, a really interestingly despairing speech up to her about like, well, the whole thing's going to fall apart. It's over
it's
when
over.
You die. But we'll, look, we'll be dead. It doesn't bother us.
The good thing is, it's not our problem. This is where we will be, you and I, right under this stone. We'll never hear the screams from inside there.
Philip.
What? You know I'm right.
Like, yep. I thought that was interesting for an attack for the show to take. What it says about Peter Morgan being a royalist or not, or if he thinks that, like, let's say Harry ruined the monarchy. I don't think that that's what Peter Morgan would say. But I think that for the show to acknowledge that the death of Elizabeth is really the beginning of the end of all of this was a surprisingly bleak
conclusion. That final moment, you know, before her long walk. Yeah. he says, all human things are subject to decay. We're a dying breed. The system makes no sense anymore to those outside of it, nor those inside it. It's like, whoa.
Okay.
You are really laying all the cards on the table in a way that, yeah, I didn't think that the show would, considering just a few episodes ago, we got like, no, all the traditions are perfect. Like, we should never change anything.
Yeah. I guess I won't say pleasantly surprised, but I was like, whoa, that is somewhat of a critical take on the crown, and it does ultimately serve to show how important Lizzie is, and I do think having Claire,
she's been kind of lost at this point on the show because Diana was so much more interesting than her. Like,
and then William and
Kate
is more interesting, and so, you know, we haven't had a moment to really sit with the Queen other than her, you know, her big night out, BE day.
Oh, right.
But I was really, what really worked for me too, along with Prince Philip being like, "Well, it's over, kids." Was the invocation of Claire Foy and Olivia Colman coming back. That I really did enjoy, the ghost of the past, her looking back at her
It's a very, like, TV device, but, you know, I love it.
Well, honey, it's TV. Why not?
It's a reunion, and it's not a reunion because they never acted together before.
No, and to see them, and to see her in conversation with herself about something that's, let's be honest, she probably never really considered that much. Like, I don't know how much shape.
Like whether, you know, retirement was ever something that was on her mind.
Yeah, that she seriously considered. But it ultimately doesn't matter because it's a television show, and that provided the episode, a somewhat disjointed episode, with a great through line and a narrative arc that did make sense. Because when you're 80, I think it's totally fair to be like, maybe I shouldn't be doing this anymore. Yeah. And I think those arguments were pretty well constructed.
And what's funny also is that it's middle-aged Olivia Colman who was like, you're tired, you should finish this. But like young Claire Foy who's like,
you said you would do this for life.
Book up.
Yeah.
Like, right. Where's that stiff upper lip?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I also thought the moment when she's, futzing with the video, the movie projector, and then she gets it to work, and then she's, what she's watching is clips from her father's funeral, right? Mm-hmm. And there's Elizabeth about to become queen, and she walks up to the wall where it's being projected and touches her old self. And, like, if I saw that in, like, a play off Broadway, I would be like, that's the most moving thing I saw on stage this year. You know? Totally. And maybe it felt a little over-egged on TV, but I was also, like, the way that this episode addresses the fact that she really did have to kind of murder her former self, smother it in bed, and then become this other thing, but still didn't forget who she used to be. Maybe, you know, maybe she's fantasizing, like romanticizing it or whatever. She was never like a woman. She wasn't like a normal person.
But no, it's very like, clear-eyed when she, you know, hears her younger self be like, no, there aren't two Elizabeths.
Yeah,
like, right. It's just one. You.
Right. This is what it was. Yeah.
I really thought that Queen Elizabeth in that moment when she touched the screen, she was going to start singing She Used to Be Mine from Waitress. Like that was the vibe. Like, this yearning for something that she no longer has, that she never maybe did, it was affecting. And I thought that...
And Imelda Staunton is a really good musical performer.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
But, you know, it's the final episode. It's going chronologically. So given the time period, there are some things that have to be sort of awkwardly shoehorned in. Like, we can't just say goodbye to Elizabeth. We have to also, you know, wrap up the Charles and Camilla storyline. And then, you know, there is the Harry and William aspect, which really is kind of discordant compared to all of this, like, Elizabeth and succession and mortality stuff.
Yeah.
And its position on Harry in the Nazi uniform is maybe as puzzling as its position on Elizabeth's greatest secret.
It's kind of lack of position. When I was watching it, I sort of... Obviously, I pay so much attention when I'm watching these episodes, but I kept rewinding, being like, did I miss a scene where they sort of dealt with the aftermath of the events of Harry dressing like a Nazi to a party? I mean, they set it up as like, Will egged him out. Nobody had any sense, you know, and everybody was too British.
Even Kate's like, oh, Harry.
You know, I wouldn't do that, but Charlie, ho!
For what it's worth, in Spare, Harry says that William and Kate encouraged him to wear the costume.
Yeah. Well, and I guess the show didn't go that far, but it went so far that everybody turns a blind eye. And then we get one scene of Harry, like, hitting himself on the toilet, like, being like, Fuck, I can't believe I did that.
But it's not because he did it, it's because he got caught.
It's in the papers, yeah. It's because it's in the papers. There's no sort of accountability there. And then the only sort of fight we get is like 30 seconds of him and William fighting in front of Charles, and Charles is being a bridezilla and is like, don't let this overshadow my wedding.
Yeah.
And I was like, there had to be... If we're going to bring this up, if we're going to go so far as to recreate that party, to not use our—and again, we don't know what actually happened. We don't know the conversations that had and the aftermath. But to not give a little bit more space to the fantasy of the reckoning that must have happened, that should have happened, seemed a little bizarre to me.
The fact that, you know, they, like, Elizabeth and Philip, like, they lived through the Blitz.
Yeah.
Like, they're in the Allies. Like, you would think that it would
be a bigger deal.
A bigger deal for your grandson to dress like a Nazi.
Philip making that little joke, being like, you got the costume wrong. I was like,
that's his reaction?
That's what we're using real estate in this show right now to do when we have so little left. And you're making the decision to include this, which timeline makes sense. I was a little confused.
Well, Elizabeth's uncle and his wife, Wallis Simpson, were... By some accounts,
Nazis.
I think that the royal family has a conflicted relationship with that era.
I mean, I guess they are German going back.
Right, exactly. But I do think that, like, using this Harry, well, they would call it a, you know, indiscretion or whatever.
And they even have Tony Blair being like, I used to get
boys,
in trouble all the time.
Boys will be boys.
Boys will dress as Nazis.
Yeah.
To use that as... an example toward the end of the episode of Elizabeth just being better at being a royal. You know, it's like, look at her, all of your descendants keep messing up and doing all this stupid stuff, and you're the only one who gets how to do this. And it's like, I think there's more at play in Harry doing that than like, he's not his grandma.
Yeah.
Like,
and I get that, like, again, this is a TV show, they have to kind of sew themes together, but, you know, especially when Harry seems to have reformed a lot in recent years. And then I just don't like the implication that's made, if at all, very, very subtly, that Harry's going to do more things that embarrass the family.
Mm-hmm. And that's the end of his arc.
I mean, like Meghan, you know, like.
Yeah. And I will say the show kind of tries to rehabilitate Harry a little bit. They have him playing with the little girls. He's so good with the children. And
he does have to muck out that stall.
He's got to muck out the stall and whatnot. So it's not that they completely let him off the hook, but I totally agree that it's like, well, he's the black sheep of the family and he made this sort of wild mistake and then he's got a lot more coming. Felt weird and like a weird place to end. In some ways, I think I felt like this is a weird place to end.
There are a few ways that the last episode is kind of mashing things together that don't necessarily mesh. It's, you know, making your like Superman toy and your like Barbie toy kiss. You're just like pushing them together. Like it has Tony Blair talking about like Iraq and like the exit strategy, and the Queen like somehow makes that about her funeral, which is like maybe sometimes things aren't about you, Lilibet.
Well, everything reflects back on Elizabeth and in this episode, in ways positive. Like, I weirdly think the Harry thing is used to be like, well, yeah, again, she's better at it. But also, and Elizabeth does allude to this, that like these people have not been good parents, and not Elizabeth and Philip, not Charles. So they're trying to kind of nuance the portrait of Elizabeth. But yeah, everything in this episode points back at her in a way that like I get, because the show is about her. But I don't know, it doesn't really satisfy
history. The juxtaposition sometimes is a little forced.
Yeah.
So on that note of Elizabeth being a bad parent, her just letting the archbishops and all of them be like, we're going to make Charles and Camilla repent for 75% of their wedding.
They have to shame themselves the whole time.
And her being like, yeah, okay, that's fine, was so crazy. And then to watch, there was some really great acting in that moment, to watch how uncomfortable to sit in that for so long was kind of delicious. It's wild that it happened. It was kind of delicious and it was good television. But it was like, oh yeah, she still doesn't give a rat's ass about
Protecting her child
or being nice to the love of his life.
And in the show's, argument or portraiture, whatever you want to call it, like, and I think this is true of real life as well, like, Elizabeth, unlike Margaret, unlike Charles, unlike a lot of other people in that family, never had to give up great love to satisfy the needs. Like, Philip was her great love, and he's
her cousin married, too.
And he's, right, and he's eligible to marry, and so we're fine. And she's not very sensitive to the fact that, like, she essentially, when she denied him Camilla 30 years prior, she was basically setting all of this in motion, but it's not her fault. You know, he's the dummy and he has to repent on the altar.
And isn't it so nice of her even in the first place to let this happen? Like, there was that aspect too, that how she's grown so much, so she's even allowing this to happen. It's like sort of like a win for Elizabeth, where then...
Yeah, just it feels like a moment in which like the show could maybe be a little more critical, or especially since it's been so sympathetic to Charles, you kind of would think that, but I don't know. It's the end, and so I guess maybe we're just taking a more celebratory perspective or something. I don't know. All of her waffling about stepping down, I'm not sure how well that worked for me too, just because we know that she didn't.
I just want, well, yes, that, but also I think that should have been introduced a couple episodes earlier.
Yeah, that's fair.
As like a possibility, you know, because I mean, obviously William said the thing about people are saying that Charles should, you know, step out, but the idea that in just this one episode, all of a sudden Elizabeth is having this enormous decision to make.
It feels abrupt.
That she invented the decision, herself.
Nobody's making her do it. I will say I did like how it affected other people in terms of like Charles getting so giddy. He's like, I'm getting married, but maybe I'll also be king. And he's like getting so excited about it. And then it's like that Jessica Lange. I was watching it and you know that Jessica Lange meme where it's like, there's not going to be a coronation, you stupid slut. Like I wanted to scream that at the TV. So I did enjoy what it engendered sort of, for other people in the show. And it was fun to see the Queen's come back and her wrestle with her past self. But it did feel like... Mm-hmm. Wholly fanciful, like a completely made-up subplot to end the series.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that I personally appreciate the beauty of bagpipe music, but I very much bought that she did.
You didn't love that?
It's not on your Spotify Wrapped?
You know, when the like housemaid starts singing along.
Again, that was another moment of theater that I was like, you know what? I like it. I don't care that
it's sort of a reverse Tomorrow Belongs to Me.
Yeah, right, exactly. Very much.
Exactly. No, I mean,
until Harry shows up.
Wait, Did the queen wear white to Camilla's wedding?
I also made a note of that because what an incredible flex.
Absolutely absurd.
In Britain, is that not rude?
No, it has to be rude all over the place. And she's literally the Miss Manners. The queen is Miss Manners for her to wear a white outfit to...
To her daughter-in-law's...
And then to do a tight five in the speech instead of saying, really, she said one nice thing about Camilla and like one nice thing about Charles, but she was like
mostly roasting.
Mostly about horses. Like, can we put
Which
the horses
in calling them old.
Yeah. Well, and implying that the race is more interesting than her son's wedding to the love of his life. Like, no, I mean, that's a saucy scene. I think that the waffling about whether or not she's going to step down stuff was like not super successful because, you know, the end of that story, but like, it is more personality than I think we got to see from Imelda Staunton. Like,
where was
until
that queen in episode six?
Right. I don't know. I wish that there had been more time for that to see her personality. And I mean, I don't know. According to Aaron Vanderhoof, who, you know, has appeared on the podcast and is a royals expert, like, yeah, the queen was known for, you know, being witty.
We did see it. Well, she played a good joke on Camilla by wearing white.
That's the punchline to a 30-year joke she played on Camilla.
And I did laugh.
It was a long con. Yeah.
We are being, I think, fairly critical of it. But I also do think that, like you said, Hillary, I was moved by parts of the episode because, you know, the performances are good. The show looks nice. Like, and also I've been watching it for however many years, you know, and six seasons. And I think that in that way it had an impact. Maybe there was no perfect way to end this show because there's just... The story is still ongoing.
You know?
Still Watching will be back in just a moment, and when we return, a conversation with executive producer Suzanne Mackey.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, "Oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?"
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's five policemen outside and two policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. So there were definitely a few surprises in the series finale of The Crown.
Yeah, we got the Nazi costume. We got Olivia Colman. We got Claire Foy.
Yes, we did.
So how did it all come together? Well, we got a chance to take a peek behind the curtain with executive producer Suzanne Mackey. She's been working closely with Peter Morgan since the inception of the series. Enjoy the conversation.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Does it feel sort of unreal that after all of these years and, you know, all of this time that the Crown is finally winding to a close?
Absolutely weird, yeah. It's been 11 years for me.
Wow.
And sort of every single day, pretty much 7 days a week, the Crown has featured heavily in my life. So it's very mixed emotions. We keep talking about it amongst us. Sort of, I talk to Peter Morgan every day, and quite a few of us are still sort of working together every day. And we're all now going, oh my God, this might be the final get together, or this might be the final moment. Well, there are milestones now we're hitting where you go that this really is the end. So it's sad.
Well, it really does go out
on a high note,
and in a really sort of emotional note. I mean, to end such a a large and epic series, it feels like it's sort of hard to figure out how exactly to do that. And to end with the queen and the three queens, really. I would love to know how, you know, you and Peter Morgan conceived of having the three queens come
back. How long was the ending kind of in the works, and how did you land on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I mean, funny enough, I remember talking to Peter about the three queens, possibility of having all three queens, as long ago as season two, I think we first started talking about it. And I think we just said, God, one day, can you imagine when we get to episode 10 of season six, that wouldn't it be wonderful to have all three? And of course, you know, those ideas are very abstract. And, you know, those things can never be inorganically imposed. They have to come from story. They have to come from a moment. You can't just sort of plonk them in there and then find, sort of go, okay, what would be our reason to have all three queens in one scene? But I think in a funny sort of way, having three queens in the final episode almost felt like part of the grammar of the whole show, in that the changing of the cast became such a significant part of the identity of the Crown, that we're traveling through time, we're telling a life story. And you get to know so intimately the younger queen and the younger Prince Philip and Charles and so on. And then the middle years and then the older years. And somehow we've always flashed back to our previous cast. You know, there's always been a reference to them. There's always been an allusion to them, as if somehow they never leave us. They are somehow the younger self is always part of the present day self, and that it's almost like a sort of, they're almost haunting the episodes. They're almost haunting. It's hard to describe it, but it's an emotional feeling of knowing that, you know, whether it's Vanessa Kirby's Margaret or Helena Bonham Carter's Margaret, their presence still feels so strong. And so when we got to episode 10 of season six, I think we knew also the Queen had died. And I think that gave it a whole other, almost a stronger need to remember her younger years and our younger years, and to sort of somehow hark back to Claire, who feels very different to Olivia's Elizabeth. And and Imelda's Elizabeth is very different to both of them as well. And just to somehow have all three in the same space felt like a tribute to our show.
Leslie Manville, when I talked to her for episode 8, she said that the Queen died while they were filming, you know, the scenes between Princess Margaret and Queen Elizabeth. That had to be, you know, sort of a really difficult thing to sort of go through while you're filming the series. So how much did that affect, I guess, the final episode, going into the final episode, having it be so much about the Queen's mortality?
Yeah, I think that's exactly that. It did change it. There's no denying it. It was Stephen Daldry's idea to have a reference to the planning of the funeral, and that suddenly felt really beautiful. And of course, that is what happened. She would, every few years, have a planning meeting about her funeral. It's a very big conversation. So the idea then for dramatizing that scene came as a result of her dying, and it felt like a very beautiful tribute for us to do organically. And it felt very, very motivated by respect and a love for her and a sort of tribute to her, that we could do that and somehow have a sense of what we know now permeate the final episode, in a sense of her contemplating the loss of her, contemplating the world without her. And I think one of the biggest influences, funny enough, for the episode came from her actual funeral. A number of us watched it together. We'd stopped filming, as you know, when she died. The day of her funeral, we stopped filming as well. But we were, many of us, together because we were filming abroad. And so a number of us, the actors, Leslie Manville and Khalid Abdullah, all got together and we watched it together in a room, and we were silent for the entire funeral. We didn't talk. We just sat and watched this extraordinary thing. And I think the thing that we were all so struck by was the music. And I remember the moment where the piper was at the top of Westminster Abbey, just quietly, with tremendous dignity, just playing on the bagpipe, and that then he moved, the bagpipe carried on playing as he walked out silently, very quietly. He walked out of the abbey with the music just drifting out into the distance and it faded away. And I thought it was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen and heard, and that it was such a beautiful tribute to her. And afterwards, I talked to Imelda Staunton about it, and she said that that for her was the most abiding, beautiful moment in the funeral. And I said, oh, I completely agree. And out of that, we talked to Peter Morgan, and out of that came the idea for the bagpipe player and the moment in the abbey. It just felt like a sort of perfect tribute to her.
Is there any, you know, documented, evidence seems like the wrong word, but is there anything documented about, you know, why the Queen did choose that song? Do you know?
No, I don't know. I don't know, actually. But it felt that we needed to have Sleep, Dearie Sleep in the episode, and that it felt so very her. And really, what we wanted was the focus to be on the Queen. We started with the Queen and we needed to end with her. So, yes, but there was no doubt that her passing hugely changed the atmosphere of episode 10. Yeah.
Was there any discussion about whether or not you should, you know, have the Harry storyline in there? Like, because it does sort of feel like an outlier. That feels a little bit like the beginning of the Harry story in a way. And, you know, the Crown can't really delve fully into it because the show is ending.
Yeah. You know, you have to be truthful to what was happening at the time, whether it be Tony Blair and Iraq, you know, what was happening with the characters. And I think, you know, the brothers were close, and we didn't want to start trying to depict a relationship that what we know now wasn't necessarily then, and it would be dishonest and disingenuous of us to try and impose now on them. But I think, you know, what you want to do is start seeing what might be small fractures, small cracks, that you might then understand why they are maybe as they are now, and that history repeats itself. So whether it was Princess Margaret and Elizabeth as the sort of the heir and the spare and the number two, that's been a recurring theme from right at the beginning, when we had even the Duke of Windsor and his brother, and, you know, the abdication story, and one feeling not right to the throne and the other feeling absolutely right to the throne. And so in many ways, that theme, that story has proliferated from the beginning. And what does that do to you in terms of family dynamic? How does that affect you? And I think history has told us what it did. Mm. And all we can do is try and reflect that and allow an audience to come to it and make up their own mind. But we've always, we rather love Harry. We do. We rather love Harry. We really love Luther as the actor playing him. I think he's marvellous. And William as well. I mean, I think the young cast, Meg, Ed, Luther, were really like a delightful end chapter.
I think I speak for both of us when I say that we would absolutely watch a spare series if you decided to do that.
100%. It's really...
I know, I would too. Trust me, I would too. It's got to be done with the fullness of time, though. When Peter Morgan can never write within. You know, the reason we finish now isn't because we ran out of story. My goodness, there's so much more story. Because he can't. And this is, you know, hats off to Peter as a dramatist, and the smartness of Peter as a dramatist is that he needs perspective. He needs to have some historical distance. He needs to be able to judge it and deconstruct it with the fullness of time. And I think if he's writing it now within, all he can do is either write it satirically or journalistically. He can't necessarily write it with a full nuance. And what he does so well is come at things from so many different perspectives and simply then tell the story as he sees it, often without judgment. Other writers could do it, but Peter, as a particular dramatist, needs to know what those complex layers are to really understand them.
I was really taken by the Queen's, you know, internal struggle as to whether or not to stay on the throne. And I wonder, I know there's a lot of research that goes into the Crown. I would love to know how that became the central arc of this episode, and how true to, you know, was there a note card that she really passed over? Was she really about to step down at Charles and Camilla's wedding?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting where Peter makes his choices in terms of dramatic license. I think that would be an example of him, using his imagination. I think it was at a time where there were some abdications that had happened in Europe, in the Netherlands, there had been an abdication. So I remember at the time we did talk about this, people were speculating about it. It had been something that had been talked about. But constitutionally and in her personality, she would never abdicate. She'd know that. And so Peter would never dream of saying, this is a conversation she was having seriously with anyone. It was purely a conversation in her head. He simply wanted to imagine what that conversation in her head might have been like. It gave him some poetic license to explore something within her head that she simply wouldn't have shared with anyone else, even her husband.
Wow. Mm.
But it was definitely poetic license.
Yeah. So Claire Foy and Olivia Colman, obviously very, very busy, very full schedules. Was it difficult to get them back to film those final scenes?
To an extent, yeah, in that they are busy, exactly that, just trying to get them to fit in with our schedule and our schedule to fit in with their schedules. it was difficult, yeah. But it was our penultimate day at York Minster, where we'd taken over York Minster for Westminster Abbey. Mm. And that final scene when the Queen walks at length of the hall to that door and lets in the light and then it closes, was we only had 1 minute left to film it, literally 1 minute left.
Really?
Otherwise we'd go into overtime and that would have been a very big pressure for us. And so we were all gathered around the monitor with Stephen Daldry. And when they said action and Imelda started to walk, it did think, oh my God, we've got it. Because technically it was a difficult shot. There were lots of cameras, the lighting, the ticking clock. And I had behind me and Stephen Daldry and the Adriana, the DP, we had Claire and Olivia watching. And then we got Imelda all the way to the door and the door opened and she walked out into the thing and the door slammed. And we all looked at each other and went, we got it. We got it. And it was incredibly emotional.
Wow.
Not because, oh, thank God we haven't gone into overtime, but because because in a way there was something very pure in that last final walk. It felt like we were all gathered together. It was like the endeavor of, you know, a journey of 1,000 steps, if you like, was sort of suddenly playing out in front of us, that simple, slow, long walk to a door was in a way a sort of metaphor for the whole journey of our journey. And the fact that Claire and Olivia were there to witness it was sort of extraordinary. And we all, in a really rather, anyone who doesn't work in the film business might consider us to be lovers in that moment. We all did turn and hug and have a bit of a tear in the eye. It felt very emotional because it felt like the door had just shut on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you said that was the penultimate day. What was the last day?
The last day by complete, and it was the antithesis in many ways, but actually just as fun, more fun. That day was somber and magisterial and beautiful and humbling, really humbling, partly because of the physical space we were in was just so glorious. The next day we were doing Charles and Camilla's wedding, where they arrive in the minibus, and there was and that felt like a sort of knees up. And the band played, and the sun shone, and we'd taken over. It felt like a very typical British day out at the seaside, you know, where everyone sort of lets their hair down and sings along in a very British way. And that had that spirit, which was really fantastic as well. So when the first AD said, that's a wrap, and that is a wrap, that was it. There was a spontaneous dance that broke out in the middle of the streets and everyone started dancing, whether it was Dominic West and all of us, we all danced around the pavements, and there was a little brass band that kept playing for us and they were playing Congratulations. And it was very funny and really lovely and everyone was smiling. And then we all just literally went, okay, bye then, bye. We all got on trains and went home.
Oh,
and
no,
that was it.
No rap party.
That's it. Wow.
Well, we did have a rap party a few weeks later, but yeah, you sort of tend to just say goodbye to each other and go off and, you know, you modestly get on a train and go home. That's it, with your bag.
So what are you hoping that viewers take away from this finale especially and, you know, the show more generally?
Well, you know, one wants to have made... We're as a company of filmmakers, you know, cast and crew, we are all determined to make great television. And I think if The Crown in the end has found a place in the canons of television that is well regarded, then I'm thrilled with that. And I know the love we have poured into it, as everyone does when they're making a show. No one does it half-heartedly. You know, you don't. You tend to do it with heart and soul. You know, we've tried to put our very best foot forward. And I think the closer we've got to the present day, the more scrutiny there is around our intentions and, you know, the whole thing about accuracy versus truth. And, you know, that can sometimes be hard because you think, oh, well, I know why we told that story in that particular way. I know what Peter meant by that. I know what was intended, and it was always well intended. I know what we did, and I'm proud of it. And I think in the end, let the audience decide.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, our final thoughts on The Crown.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
So before we close out our season on The Crown forever, I'm curious if either of you feel like The Crown, however much of it you've watched, has changed your perception of the royals positively or negatively.
I guess I'll start as the person who's watched the least amount of The Crown, even though now I do want to go back and watch the Clairefoy seasons because there's a lot of interesting, it's fascinating. There's a lot of interesting history, and I do think history is important, and I don't think we should ignore things that are problematic and potentially bad for the world. The Crown, I think watching this, and I'm probably going to echo a little bit of what a lot of the actors that we've talked to have said, if anything, my respect for the institution, the idea that, like, the royal family needs to exist has plummeted, has gone down. It wasn't that high to begin with, but it's definitely lower than before. But I do have empathy and begrudging respect and, yeah, sympathy for people who are thrust in that position and how difficult that can be, right? That these are actually all human beings that have these lives that they opt into every single day, which are full of problematic and somewhat terrible stuff. And those who railed against, like our girl Diana, suffered insane consequences, and Dodie and so many others, in whatever way they transgressed. But I think it's curious. I think it's fascinating. I would watch so much more. I want to read more about it. I want to know more about it, but I do think it is bad. If that makes any sense.
It being the monarchy.
It being the monarchy, yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the show protests too much in its support for the monarchy. I would agree with that. I think we do have to just give it a lot of credit, though, for finding new things to say, or just, like, for channeling, like, the interest in this most scrutinized, like, family in the history of the world. And, like, making a case for them existing, but also making a case for the show existing. Like, I think that the Diana stuff especially, you know, we've talked about it ad nauseum, and she is just an interest, like an object of fascination, like for all the reasons that we've talked about. But, like, The Crown really did do a great job of fleshing her out, giving a new perspective on her, painting her as somebody complicated, you know, not a victim, mm-hmm. but not just this, like, manipulative schemer, and not, like, this crazy woman, like, crazy scorned woman. Like, she's all of those things, and she's, you know, also rational, and she's also kind of calculating, but also
fun,
naive.
And she's a good mother. Fun, she's fun, and she's flirty.
I mean,
and she's,
I don't want to discount the work of, you know, the actresses who have played the queen, especially. But I do think that the Diana stuff is where the show has been most successful, most consistent, and, Yeah, that where it makes like the best case for like why we care or like should care so much about this person specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if I roll my eyes at, you know, a royal's obsession, I have to roll my eyes at like Kennedy's obsession. You know, like this is just something that like is part of culture. And I think that, you know, kind of to your point, Chris, about that these people opt in every day, I think that the show made that clear while also showing the undertow of it. It's actually pretty hard to leave this, not just because there's all of this demand placed on you, but like this is still your family.
Yeah.
And it's the only thing you know. And of course, money's involved in that. And I think that the show depicting people who are both trapped in it, but also kind of devoted to it, and even Diana to some extent, like she didn't let go a lot of the trappings of the life, even though she left the marriage. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way this show, and I don't know that Peter Morgan or anyone else would describe it themselves this way, but like I think the show did a good job and a compelling job throughout the seasons of depicting that sort of like existential stuckness. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. This is the only thing I know and I can't leave it. And that does make me empathize a little bit more with the real people, even though, yes, they could all collectively make the decision, maybe follow Harry's lead a little bit and say, we're going to pack this in.
Yeah, pack it up.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted more of it in terms of, you know, not necessarily like being more critical of the institution or of the people, but just, not necessarily just trying to prop them up as it did in the later seasons. Like,
yeah.
I just think it could have done more to illustrate ambiguities and, you know, not especially, you know, some of this dialogue is so on the nose in the last seasons. Like, I don't know if that's a consequence of, I don't know, having to wrap things up or what. But yeah, I just think that there is nuance that got kind of muted as the show went on that I wish hadn't.
Yeah.
Right.
And
yeah.
For all my, you know, hemming and hawing, was I moved by the three queens standing together in black as the queen was walking out of the chapel? Yeah, I was moved. I thought that was, you know, I understood the importance. I understood why people feel so strongly about her. Do I feel that way? That's, you know, neither here nor there. But yeah.
Regardless of your feelings, she was a figure who loomed large for the better part of a century. And that's significant.
You can't say that about many people or many things.
And when that score on the crown is really blaring away, you're like, this does feel significant. So good job all on that.
You want to stand and salute.
Yeah, well, maybe you stand, but with my back to them. I don't know. Well, that does it for this episode and season of Still Watching, but fear not. We will be back very soon in the new year with a new show. I don't know that we're ready to announce that yet, but it's going to be on HBO and stars with Detective.
Yeah, maybe even two.
It might.
Not a false detective.
It rhymes with blue defective.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. And actually, the people on that show are pretty blue and pretty defective.
A lot to look forward to.
So we'll be back on your feed very soon. Until then, you can find me on various social medias at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on social media at Chris Triss.
And you can find me at Hillabuster with two R's.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we have production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Gabe Quiroga. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. Again, we'll be back in the new year with a new show that we'll be dissecting episode by episode, and we're really looking forward to seeing you then.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.